phenomenological approach than my predecessors, which sounds great, but in practice it means that I won't have any comparison with actual data, so it's not so great after all. But this is the approach I'm going to take, okay? So let me first explain what I mean by local, okay? I actually mean two. Is this working? Yes. It means two things, okay? The first thing it means is that I'm going to look for a local four-dimensional model of modified gravity, okay? And the reason being that we like four dimensions because apparently we live in them, and we like local field theories because we understand them, okay? So that's what I'm going to do. And the second meaning I attach to local for this talk is that I'm going to concentrate on distances much smaller than Hubble, okay? And the reason for this is going to be clear in a few minutes, hopefully. So, by the way, do I have 45 minutes, is that right? Including questions and discussion. Okay. So, let me briefly review why we like general relativity so much and why we use it. Well, the traditional viewpoint is that general relativity is beautiful, is elegant. It's so nice that it cannot be false. And, of course, that is not a really satisfactory viewpoint. And fortunately, we understood something more. And the reason general relativity is so good and it works so well is that upon minimal assumptions, which I'm going to review in a second, it's essentially the unique low-energy theory for spin to gravitons, okay? And so our model viewpoint is that that's why general relativity works, because there are gravitons in the real world. Now, on the other hand, at long distances, we know that there's something at least unsatisfactory, psychologically speaking. It's not perhaps a technical inconsistency, but certainly the cosmological constant problem is a big drawback of our understanding of general relativity, okay? We have no explanation for why the cosmological constant is so small in general relativity, and indeed, probably the best explanation is the anthropic one, and so far. And related to this, the fact that the universe is accelerating is actually telling us that the cosmological constant is not zero because of some hidden symmetry that we haven't been clever enough yet to discover, but it's actually tiny. There's a tiny value there, and so it's even slightly more puzzling, at least, once again, psychologically. There's no real technical meaning I can attach to this word, okay? And so it makes sense to look for infrared modifications of gravity, modifications of gravity at large distances, as we all know. And as we all know, it's a very difficult task, okay? It's a very difficult task, and the reason is essentially because of the uniqueness of GR as a good theory of gravity. That is to say, assuming that the graviton is a spin-to particle, that it is massless, and that it obeys a Lorentz invariant dynamics, one can show that GR is, in fact, the only possible theory of this kind of gravitons, okay? So in order to avoid the conclusion, so in order to not to have, if you want, in order not to have GR, we need to give up some of the assumptions, okay? Now, on the spin to nature of the graviton, we don't have many doubts. I mean, we know from, for instance, light bending experiment that whatever is mediating the gravitational force is mostly a spin-to object, okay? So we don't want to give up that. People have tried to give up the masslessness, okay? And so to write down theories for massive gravitons, the simplest possibility is the so-called Diels-Pauli massive gravity, and it's known it has many theoretical inconsistencies, okay? So it's a pretty bad theory, so it doesn't really work. The other possibility is to give up Lorentz invariance, perhaps by not by breaking it explicitly, because otherwise it's not clear really how to write down a consistent gravitational theory, but spontaneously, okay, with some Lorentz invariant, Lorentz violating condensate. And this gives rise to a number of possibilities. The simplest is the so-called Gauss condensate, which is a pretty good theory from the theoretical consistency viewpoint, okay? There are a number of variants that if you want, you can call Lorentz violating massive gravities. They are all variations of this idea, and they are considerably better than the Lorentz invariant version, the field product version. Okay? We can also give up an assumption that was implicit in all this discussion, which is that of locality. Okay? And for instance, an example that we all know along this direction is the so-called DGP model, okay, in which you have a theory that is intrinsically a five-dimensional theory, okay? And so from the four-dimensional viewpoint, it's not a local theory. You cannot describe it by a local Lagrangian in four dimensions. And it has some good and bad features, okay, some good features and some bad ones, which I'm going to review now. And this is, if you want, my starting point. I will start from DGP and will look at the four-dimensional approximate description of DGP. And I will try to generalize that in order to retain the good features and get rid of the bad ones, okay? Now, in all these examples, there's a regime, namely the regime at which you concentrate on distances much shorter than Hubble, in which the deviations from general relativity, so the modifications we introduced, general relativity, are effectively described by a new light scalar degree of freedom that is mixed with the metric, okay? By mixed with the metric, I mean that for, let's say, for small gravitational fields, the action takes more or less this form. There is a conformal factor, let me call this scalar degree of freedom pi, okay? There is a conformal factor in front of the metric that mixes the graviton and the scalar. There is a non-trivial dynamics for pi, okay, which is going to be, in a sense, the focus of my talk, okay? But so far, it, I don't want to specify what it is. And then I have the standard coupling to matter, okay? Which means that upon the mixing the scalar from the metric, that is to say by redefining the metric in order to get rid of this pi in front of R, okay, what I get is just GR plus a scalar theory coupled to the trace of the stress energy tensor universally, okay? Universally meaning with the same strength for all species. And one example is, of course, DGP, okay? DGP, it's been shown that the short distances, the distances shorter than the cross, at the critical scale, the action, the four-dimensional action, can be written as GR plus a scalar with a peculiar self-interaction term, okay, plus coupling to matter.
Pi might be confused with the pi and the GR.
Yes.
You mean 1 over 16 pi g?
Yeah.
Cancel
each other.
So let's run it, yes. Yeah, it's called pi because it's some sort of Gaussian boson, so like pi. Okay, so you can say the same for the kind of Lagrangian for pi.
I would.
Okay, yes, thank you. Let's try not to confuse pi with 3.14. Yes. Okay, and it turns out that this description, which I say it's only approximate in the sense that it works only at short distances, it's in fact extremely powerful at short distances in the sense that it gets rid of all the complication of the five-dimensional physics of DGP, okay, and it encodes the non-trivial new features of DGP as compared to GR in just a scalar field with a peculiar self-interaction, okay? And in particular, for instance, if you have a compact source, let's say the sun, okay, you know that, first of all, matter will be coupled to the GR part there, okay? So you will have the Newtonian potential that goes like 1 over R, okay? Now, because of this coupling, you will also have a pi field that goes like 1 over R, and you know that this is incompatible with a solar system test, because, for instance, you get the bending of light wrong, okay? But what makes the theory interesting is that this same interaction, in fact, becomes important when you move close to the source, okay? And at distances that are huge, for instance, for the sun is, what is it? It's like 10 to the 20 centimeters, something like that. Sorry?
10 parsecs.
Which
are the two numbers the same?
You got the other pieces, so okay. Anyway, some big distance, okay? Bigger than the solar system, that's the important.
Yes.
Bigger than the solar system.
Linearity is turned on, okay, and they effectively screen
the scalar force at short distances. So this non-linearity, if you want, is crucial for the model to be consistent with what we know about gravity in the solar system, okay, or at short distances in general. This is called the Weinstein effect because Weinstein hypothesized its existence for massive gravity, okay? And in DGP, it works beautifully. The theory is nice because there is no conflict with solar system tests. On the other hand, the predictions of the theory are not identical to those of GR in the solar system in the sense that this screening is not perfect, so you have some non-trivial observational prediction also in the solar system, apart from cosmology, okay? And perhaps what's most interesting is that the same nonlinearity that is responsible for screening the scalar at short distances is also responsible for sustaining the so-called self-accelerating solution of DGP in this language, okay? And the reason is the following. So suppose you turn off matter, okay? So you set the stress energy tensor to zero. Now, that pi Lagrangian is as a nonlinearity, so the equation of motion is a nonlinear equation of motion. It turns out, at the level of counting of powers of pi, it's a second-order equations of motion. And there are two very symmetric solutions in the absence of sources. One is the trivial solution, and the other is this sort of maximally symmetric solution. Okay? Once again, I'm focusing at distances much shorter than Hubble, so the fact that I have these things that blow up at infinity doesn't really bother me, okay, because this is going to be actually matched to the actual cosmological expansion, but I look at it close enough so that it's just a small correction. When I go and compute the total metric seen by matter, which is the so-called Einstein frame metric plus this correction due to pi, I discover that this second solution here, well, the first solution, of course, corresponds to flat space, okay, not surprisingly. H mu nu here, the Einstein frame metric is zero because the stress energy tensor is zero, so I'm not producing any gravitational field. Okay, so the first solution corresponds to flat space. The second solution locally corresponds to the Sitter space. That is to say, if I take the Sitter metric and I expand locally about a point, about any point, because of course the Sitter is homogeneous, I discovered that there exists a gauge in which the metric takes exactly this form. This is to say, h squared x alpha times eta mu. Okay? So this describes precisely the so-called self-accelerating solution of DGP in a local patch. Local patch much smaller than Hubble. Okay? And if you want, the self-accelerating solution is also the reason why the DGP model triggered so much interest in the first place. Okay? And it's nice because in this description, in this local description, we can recover it straightforwardly. Now, unfortunately, as you know, the so-called self-accelerating solution is unstable against the small fluctuations. That is to say, if I consider small fluctuations about it, so I expand the Lagrangian of pi as the solution plus a small phi, okay, and I expand the quadratic order, I discover that phi has a negative kinetic term, okay? Negative kinetic term means negative energy, means the solution is unstable. And this statement has been verified in full five-dimensional calculations, okay? But it was predicted first in this language. Okay? It was predicted first in the language of the local four-dimensional description. So the solution is unstable, it means that it's untenable, okay? You cannot trust it. And all this makes sense locally, as we said. And whereas at double distances, the description breaks down, the four-dimensional description breaks down because the theory is intrinsically five-dimensional, and at double distances, you start seeing the fifth dimension, okay? So which from the viewpoint of four-dimensional physics is a non-locality. Now, what I'm going to do is consider whether this connection that we found between the self-accelerating solution and the stability is a generic feature, okay, of theories where the same logic applies. That is to say, for theories where the deviations from GR in a local patch, much smaller than Hubble, are mediated by an effective scalar degree of freedom mixed with the metric, where mixed with the matrix simply means that upon demixing, that scalar is universally coupled to a stress energy tensor. And I want it to be universally coupled to a stress energy tensor in order not to violate the equivalence principle. Okay? In fact, Lam tomorrow will have a lot to say about this coupling and its connection to the equivalence principle, but for sure, if we want to preserve the equivalence principle, you want the scalar to be coupled to all species with equal strength. Okay? And so why do I want to do that? Because of the examples above, because even if I have much more complicated theories like massive gravity or DGP, in the end, at short distances, empirically what we find is that there's a new scalar degree of freedom with these properties, okay? So I take it as some sort of pattern that repeats itself, and so a pattern that is sensible to, that is, makes sense to study, okay? And also because it's the simplest possibility, a scalar field is the simplest possibility. And the next possibility would be a vector, but you know that coupling a vector, at least at linear order, to the stress energy tensor is not really feasible, because just to match indices, you have to put a derivative, and for a conserved stress energy tensor, this coupling vanishes, okay? So a vector cannot couple the stress energy tensor at linear order, okay? Now, and the desired properties of my theory are going to be the following. I want that my theory entails order one modifications on cosmological scales. On the other hand, I want to have negligible effect in the solar system, or at least compatibility with the solar system best. Okay? I want to reproduce a self-accelerating solution of DGP, but I want it this time to be stable, okay, against small perturbations. And I do not want to assume that my scalar is as a global scalar degree of freedom, okay, simply because it would be an unnecessary assumption, since this is not the case in DGP or massive gravity, okay? So I want to focus on local scales and try to see how far I can go by assuming these things without assuming that I can promote my scalar degree of freedom to some scale, some four-dimensional scalar on all scales, okay? So in order to make sense of this restriction, I want, first of all, to describe cosmology locally about a point as a small gravitational field, okay? And of course I can do this because of the equivalence principle. About any point, I can choose clever coordinates such that for a small enough region, space-time is approximately flat plus small corrections, okay? So there's many ways of doing this. There's many gauges you can choose. And a particular convenient one for us, for a reason that will be clear in a minute, is some sort of conformal gauge. That is to say, I want this weak H mu nu to be conformally flat, okay? And it turns out that for FRW, I can do this, okay? And the gauge is the following. So you see that locally, about a point, I'm choosing a given point as the origin, and I'm measuring time and x from that point. So now this x is physical x, okay? It's not commoving x. And you see that the metric is flat times a conformal factor that becomes exactly one at the origin of space and time, okay? And the deviations from one are x squared and t squared. So this is really like focusing on the Riemann tensor at that point and expanding the metric as flat plus Riemann times x squared, okay? So at distances and times shorter than Hubble scale, this is approximately flat. Okay?
It's isotropic, so photons don't see this. So is this generally true that, like, locally photons don't see that dimension, but matter does?
Sorry?
Just saying, since that matter does see the expansion of the universe, but photons don't.
That's true.
Well, for instance, you know that for matter you have some redshift of peculiar velocities.
But if you have a flat universe, it's conformally flat. But if it's curved, then it's not conformally.
No, sorry, this is a flat FRW.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay,
this is a FRW.
Good.
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
Perfect.
Yes, indeed. So even the full nonlinear FRD resolution is conformal.
Sure, I can ask. So, yes.
Okay. Anyway, so this is just a kinematical statement, okay? So given any metric, that is to say,
even in the modified gravity theory, so you want to describe your theory with a metric, okay, in the sense that that's the full metric seen by matter, okay? Given any cosmological metric, I can rewrite it in this form, close to any point and at any time, okay? And now we introduce the scalar, degree of freedom, okay? That is to say, we supplement the GR action with a scalar with an unspecified dynamics for now, universally coupled to the stress energy tensor. So if you want, I'm already working here in Einstein frame. That is to say, I'm putting the scalar in front of T mu mu and not in front of the GR action. Okay? Now, the logic will be that we allow for generic nonlinearities in L pi, because that's the lesson we learned from DGP, that interesting physics is going to come from there. Okay? On the other hand, we keep the lowest order in H mu mu, because that's also the interesting lesson in DGP. In DGP, by studying this four-dimensional effective description, you learn that there is, if you want, nonlinearities of GR and nonlinearities in this scalar degree of freedom are totally disentangled, and in particularly the nonlinearities in the scalar sector are much stronger than those in GR. So even for systems that are not black holes, for instance, you have in DGP huge nonlinearities in the scalar sector. Okay? That was that picture with the sun and the pi profile. Okay? So we can treat the Einstein metric as a linear perturbation and work at nonlinear level in pi. Okay? And the physical metric seen by matter, okay, since matter couples to both GR and pi, is the sum of the two. Okay? Now, I'm going to adopt a totally arbitrary definition of what I mean by interesting modification of gravity, okay? And my definition is the following, that I want the force directly mediated by pi to be the leading effect. That is to say, I want the stress energy tensor of pi to be a small perturbation in comparison to the fact that I have a new degree of freedom mediating directly a new force, okay? That is to say, I want to say that I want to neglect, at least in the at the distance case at which I'm interested in, I want to neglect the gravitational back reaction of pi, okay? The main modification of gravity is going to come in this Einstein frame description by the force mediated directly by pi and not by its gravitational back reaction, okay? Of course, this is an assumption that you have to check once you have the solutions, okay? But you can do it, of course. And so in this case, if we go back to our action, well, it's immediate to discover that if I can neglect the back reaction of pi, for given sources, and of course given boundary conditions, the Einstein frame metric is the same metric that I would have in GR, okay? So this is a trivial statement. If I can neglect the gravitational field produced by pi, the solution for the gravitational field is just that produced by T mu nu as in GR, okay? Why is this important? So this is a trivial statement. Why is it important for us? It's important because it means that we can extract the solution for pi just by comparing the full metric and the metric we would have in GR in the presence of the same sources. Okay, that is to say, let's say I want a solution that is self-accelerating, and I know that in GR, I know the solution that I would have in GR instead with the same distribution of sources. Well, by taking the difference of these two metrics, okay, so the metric that I would like to have, and the metric that I would have in GR with the same sources, by taking the difference of these two metrics, I can extract the pi profile that I need. Okay, it's a geometric statement because so far we haven't specified the dynamics of pi. We are just specifying how pi enters in the metric. There's a number of ambiguities here, okay? The first obvious ambiguity is that, okay, I'm comparing two metrics. These are not gauge invariant quantities, so you should be more specific about the gauge, okay, about the coordinate system, okay? And so this is the first ambiguity, the gauge ambiguity. And that's why it was convenient for us to rewrite FRW in conformal gauge, okay? We want to compare these two metrics in conformal gauge simply because the left-hand side is a conformal factor, okay? So if you don't use conformal gauge, it means that, I mean, the difference is not in the form of the left-hand side, and so you have to apply some gauge transformations to put it in that form, okay? So this is just a cautionary remark that you should be careful about defining properly the gauge. But that's not enough, okay? This gauge choice is not unique because it's invariant. The gauge constraint, the fact that the H mu be conformal, is invariant under conformal transformations, because by definition, conformal transformations are transformations of the coordinates that leave the metric conformally flat. Okay? So there is still an ambiguity that has to do with conformal transformations. Okay? And you can check that conformal transformations at the order we are working at, that is to say at linear order in H mu, act on pi in the following way. They act like a constant shift. This corresponds to dilations. And a linear shift like this. And this corresponds to special conformal transformations. Okay? So infinitesimal conformal transformations act like this on pi. Well, one could say, okay, in order to get rid of this ambiguity, instead of comparing the metrics, let me compare gauge invariant quantities like the curvature tensors, okay? So we could compare the curvature tensors and take the difference and define that as the modification of the curvature tensor due to pi. And you know that for pi appearing as a conformal factor in front of the metric, the modification to the Riemann, to the Ricci, for instance, at linear order in pi has to do with derivatives of, second derivatives of pi, which are, once again, insensitive to this transformation, okay? Because the transformation only changes the zero and the first derivative of pi, okay? So we have some ambiguity in defining the pi that produces the solution we like, okay? Now, just to show you that I'm not crazy, let me tell you how this works explicitly in DGP, okay? So in DGP, I'm claiming, so according to the discussion we just had, I'm claiming that if you know the correct Friedman-Robertson-Walker solution in DGP and the corresponding solution in GR at the same value of the sources, so at the same rho and same P, you can take the difference between those two factors appearing in my metric, which are nothing but the Newtonian potentials in this approximation in which I zoom in around some point and I treat FRW as a small perturbation, okay? So I take the difference between those two metrics in conformal gauge. The difference takes this form, okay? So it's some x squared, t squared factor weighted by the differences in h dot and h squared between DGP and GR at the same values of rho and p, okay? Plus the ambiguity we were talking about, okay? And now the claim is that this is precisely the so-called brain bending mode isolated by Luti, Porrati, and Rattazzi that was had that action I was referring to at the beginning of the talk, which is to say that d pi square plus pi t plus that funny cubic interaction with four derivatives, okay? And to check this claim, what do I do? Well, I plug these configuration for pi in the equation of motion derived from that action. Equation of motion derived by these guys, okay? And the result is that it's a perfect identity, okay? And I want to stress that this is an identity without any funny limit, like usually people say that in DGP that four-dimensional action you get it in some sort of decoupling limit in which you send the mass of the graviton to zero and you send them Planck to infinity, okay? So here, it works without any approximation. The reason being that by zooming around a given point, okay, and keeping only the lowest order corrections to the metric about that point, we are, in fact, isolating the physics that is most relevant at short distances, okay? And so if you want, from my viewpoint, at least this is a more physical way of defining what we mean by the coupling limit in DGP. The coupling limit in DGP means do not take any parameter to zero to infinity, but just concentrate on short distances, okay? And if you do that, it works beautifully. Okay, so we now come to the construction of L pi. So on the one hand, we want, as we said, order one modifications to the cosmological evolution. On the other hand, we want negligible effects in the solar system. And of course, there's a tension between these two things, okay? So pi should be important here, should not be important here, okay? And the tension, of course, can only be resolved if you allow for some nonlinear dynamics. For a linear field, the relative effect of pi on cosmological scales and on solar system scales would be identical, okay? So you need some nonlinearities. And here comes the assumption, which is just an assumption that I'm going to explain the logic of the assumption as well, okay? So the assumption is the following. If the equation of motion for pi, which is functional derivative of its action plus the coupling to the stress energy tensor, is in fact an algebraic equation for the correction to the curvature induced by pi, okay, then the corrections to the geometry are locally determined algebraically by the distribution of matter, okay? What I'm saying is that this is the gauge invariant measure of how the geometry is corrected by pi, okay? And if the equation of motion of pi, they take this form where f is some polynomial, okay, some function, some algebraic function, you don't even have to solve a differential equation to relate how geometry is affected by matter, okay? This is just an algebraic equation, okay? Which means that the Weinstein effect, if it's there, is going to be very robust, okay? It's going to be implemented essentially in any situation you want, okay? Because you just have to decide the form of this F, and this F is telling you when the nonlinearities should kick in order to screen, to make the corrections to the geometry small, okay? So I'm not claiming that this is the only possible implementation of the only possible robust implementation of screening. For instance, the chameleon is probably equally robust.
Because, I mean, so what is team U for dark matter? If you look at the smallest scales, you have denser and denser clumps, and so it's, I mean, the thing is density depends on the way you coarse grain things. And you never actually know what the actual density is.
Sorry, but this is the same for GR, no?
But the thing, if delta R is a linear function of T, then you know how to, then coarse grain equation doesn't change it. But if it's a nonlinear function, then coarse grain it will change it.
I see. You're saying that coarse grain will change this.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, it's because F is nonlinear.
You're saying that everything is difficult to solve because it's nonlinear?
Yeah, I mean, that's space. No, it's not just, it's more than that. It's not even well defined because, I mean, if I put everything in dark matter particles that have very much larger density, I mean, if you want to define density for a single dark matter particle, it's going to be much higher.
But do you agree that this is much more, at least conceptually, robust than having an actual nonlinear?
I think it needs to have some smoothing length in it, some sort of Compton wavelength. Otherwise, I don't think it's well defined because densities aren't as smooth cosmologically.
The same problem exists in GR. You are talking about the fact we have to solve, no? That
yeah,
GR, that T mu nu is related to the metric in a nonlinear way, so if you smooth the T mu nu, it's not the same thing as smoothing the metrics, so that's actually a problem. Same kind of issue might arise here.
But that's not an algebraic function. So
algebraic is actually even better.
I mean, for example, imagine this Weinstein effect. So let's say it's an algebraic relationship. If it's just a function of density, then I can take a star and make it a black hole, right? And everything is going to be different, right? From at infinity, so you don't have Kirchhoff's theorem, right? And so that's the question I have. So you have a small scalar structure in dark matter, and if you don't resolve and you have no idea what it is, so are they going to be as screened? Or are
I think this is related actually to questions Lang will address in his talk, no? No, in the sense that it has to do with the, in a sense, it has to do with the absence of the Virchow theorem.
Yeah.
No, I'm not sure it has to do with coarse graining, but it has to do with the absence of the Virchow theorem. Okay. Mm-hmm. And well, but for sure, the more microscopic, the most microscopic you are in your description, the more exact is the statement you make. Of course, at some level, you cannot coarse grain everything.
But if it's algebraic, I just said that if you want to implement in the simulation, it's going to really very much depend on the resolution of your simulation, because if you have
it depends on. I mean, if you get the DDP case, then you have something that looks like Gauss's law. So it goes back. I mean, it doesn't matter. Even though, okay, so the details of really close by aren't going to.
But it's not algebraic in DGP.
No, this is generalization of DGP. I mean, in DGP, I'm going to tell you exactly what it is. But Mark is right. Here too, you will have a Gauss law. Okay, it's going to be a nonlinear Gauss law. So in a sense, if you want the mass inside the mass inside a sphere is going to be well defined, even though. 5 minutes?
I see
9 minutes in my
time. Okay, yeah, you're right. Sorry.
Okay, anyway, yeah.
Kind of a numerical check on your worry, which is that people like Roman, Mark, and Fabian have run DGP simulations. Presumably, when they change the resolution, you can ask, does the law Waymo grow? The growth actually differs if you run different resolutions. And I assume the answer is yes, it's robust, no?
Yeah.
I assume on large scale.
The answer is no,
growth.
It doesn't change.
Yeah,
it
doesn't change.
It's robust.
It's robust.
The way you do it.
So that's kind of a possibility.
But I think that one crucial feature of this is, as Mark was saying, the presence of the Gauss law. It's a nonlinear Gauss law, which makes things inside a given volume to be well defined independent of
so perhaps it's related to why the simulations are robust. Anyway, as I said, I'm not claiming that this is the unique way of implementing Weinstein's mechanism in some very general way, okay? But what's interesting about this way of doing so is that it's associated with a symmetry, okay? And the following, in the following sense. So, recall that the correction to r mu nu coming from pi is associated with the second derivatives of pi. So the statement that the equation of motion be an algebraic function of r mu nu is the statement that the equation of motion be an algebraic function of second derivatives of pi. Okay? And this equation of motion is invariant under the famous ambiguity that we had, which from this viewpoint we promote to a symmetry. Okay? We say, let me assume that this is in fact a symmetry of the dynamics of pi, okay? And in this way, I'm forced to have at least, in the equations of motion, I'm forced at least to have two derivatives on each pi, okay? By the way, we call this the Galilean, an internal Galilean invariance, because, of course, it's analogous to the Galilean shift of velocities in non-relativistic mechanics, with x nu playing the role, x mu playing the role of t, and pi of x playing the role of x of t. Okay, so it's a generalization of Galilean invariance. And as I said, the equation of motion, because of this symmetry, if we demand this symmetry in the Lagrange, the equation of motion are going to involve at least two derivatives on each pi. On the other hand, in order not to have ghosts, we want the equations of motion to involve at most two derivatives on each pi, okay? Otherwise, for a higher order equation of motion, you know you start having instabilities, okay? So in a sense, the fact that there are exactly two derivatives on each pi is satisfying both requirements, okay? So that's a good feature. And so we are now led to construct the most generic invariant, generic Galilean invariant Lagrangian, okay? And just by power counting, in order to have two derivatives for each field in the equation of motion, you need for n pi's in a Lagrangian term, you need this many derivatives, okay? The simplest is 1 pi, okay, with zero derivatives. Okay? Its equation of motion is 1, and of course it's Galilean invariant because it's invariant under anything. The next to simplest is just a kinetic term, okay? Two pi's and two derivatives. Its contribution to the equation of motion is box pi, which is obviously invariant under Galilean transformations. The less trivial, the first non-trivial term, if you want, is the DGP interaction, okay? This doesn't look to have any nice property, but once you derive its contribution to the equation of motion, it turns out to be d nu pi all squared minus box pi squared, okay? So two derivatives for each field. And the reason Galilean invariance is not manifest at all in the action is that it's a derivative of the action, the Lagrangian, shifts by a total derivative under Galilean transformation, okay? So it's not trivial to figure out what are the actual combinations of pi and derivatives that give you Galilean invariant equations of motion. Anyway, you can classify completely all the possible invariants, and it turns out that in four dimensions there are only five, okay? And in fact, in d dimensions there are d plus one, okay, you can show. And it's an algebraic argument. And they are this. I'm using the compact notation in which capital pi is the matrix of second derivatives, okay, and the bracket is just a trace of matrix indices, and of course the dot is just a standard Lorentz contraction. And, I mean, of course we don't need to follow the details here of the terms, it's just to show you that we have a very specific structure for the terms, okay, and these Galilean invariant terms are unique. There's no other possible. Sorry?
Finite number?
Yes, well, it's an algebraic, as I said, in D dimensions, there are D plus one, and the reason has to do with the fact that you cannot write down a generic equation of motion involving second derivatives of the field, because you have to impose that equation of motion comes from the variation of a Lagrangian. Okay, this turns out to be a very strong constraint that turns out to imply that in D dimensions there are only D plus one possibilities of doing so. Okay, one at each order in pi, so first order, second order, third order, fourth order, fifth order. In D dimensions you go up to D plus first order, okay? I mean, we can go through the details if you want the derivation, but it's just some technical statement. There is no physical intuition. At least I don't have any physical intuition. Now, in conclusion, the Lagrangian is very constrained, okay? So if we make that assumption that the equation of motion only depends on second derivatives of the field or only depends on the modification to the Ricci curvature, the Lagrangian is just a sum of five terms with five free coefficients. So you have five coefficients in your model, but all the rest is fixed. And this makes a thorough analysis of very symmetric solutions very doable, okay? First of all, because you have a few free parameters, and second, because for highly symmetric configurations, and given the high degree of symmetry of the Lagrangian, the actual problem you have to solve in order to study, for instance, the existence and stability of very symmetric solutions, turns out to be an algebraic problem, okay? So for instance, for finding the analog of the Sitter self-accelerating solution, and to study spherical solutions about it, for instance, to see whether you have implementation of the Weissner effect, this is just an algebraic problem, okay? So let me just give you the result. There are good news, and of course, I mean, there's going to be bad news. I mean, since I specify good news, there's going to be a downside. So there are stable self-accelerating solutions. So we reproduce the self-accelerating solution of DGP, but now it's stable. And in fact, we find several such solutions, okay? So we find several such solutions because, in a sense, DGP equation of motion is a quadratic equation for this second derivative structure. In our case, it's a quartic equation. So we have much more, many more solutions. We have stable Weinstein-like spherical solutions that describe the field produced by compact sources, both about flat space and about these self-accelerating solutions, okay? And they are stable, so if you want, in this model you can describe a stable solar system, which is what, where we live. And the bad news is that if you now consider small perturbations about this spherically symmetric solution, the solution is stable against the small perturbations, but some perturbations are superluminal, okay? In particular, radial perturbations move superluminally. And it turns out, so originally we thought it was a problem of these solutions, and so perhaps we thought, perhaps this can avoid, can be avoided by imagining a more realistic situation in which you have, like in the universe, a bunch of compact sources, so you don't have spherical symmetry about any point, and so perhaps this is an accident of spherical symmetry. It turns out that it's a much more general problem, okay? You can show that, in fact, for instance, I won't go through the details, but for instance, you can show that for linear solutions, so that they are not in the Weinstein regime, for linear solutions, there's always going to be a direction in which perturbations about linear solutions are superluminal, okay? And in fact, you can argue that one possible way out is to impose that you cannot propagate about these solutions, you cannot propagate perturbations whose frequency is higher than Hubble, okay? And of course, that's very unsatisfactory, because also our original viewpoint was to focus on distances smaller than Hubble, so it's a contradiction, if you want. And the reason you could be safe from superluminarity by imposing this is because superluminality does not correspond to superluminal propagation of actual signals if you do not gain over a strictly luminal signal if you do not gain at least one wavelength, okay? So if you do not gain a phase of order one, you're not really propagating any signal. Of course, we can be more precise, so the precise violation of causality would be if a signal like this propagates superluminal, okay? But just think in terms of waves, if I have a wave packet, I propagate a signal if I gain at least one wavelength. Anyway, so it turns out that for low enough frequencies, you don't propagate superluminal signals, but these frequencies are very low, okay? So, no. So in the
Weinstein-like solution,
you are superluminal of order one, because the superluminality shift is always the size of nonlinearity, okay? So for a Weinstein-like solution, which is nonlinear of order one, the superluminality is of order one, okay? For linearized solutions, it's suppressed by this L. L, I use here L as a length scale that measures how linear you are, okay? But it's really a one-to-one correspondence between nonlinearity and superluminarity. Yes? No. Yeah, of course, I mean, in order to have a non-trivial modification to the dispersion relation of perturbations, you need to take into account the nonlinearity. But it's a perturbative statement, no? The nonlinearity is very small. If the nonlinearity is very small, the shift in the speed of light is very small, but it's finite. And indeed, that's why, I mean, by playing with the frequency and the distance you propagate the wave, you can avoid superluminal signals. So I understand that I have minus 3 minutes. Okay, so let me just, faster than the speed of light, so now I have 5 minutes, no, because we went back in time. okay, very, very quickly, quantum mechanically, this system, this Galileo, is the same as DGP. That is to say, naively, since I have these strong nonlinearities in the scalar Lagrangian, suppressed by a tiny energy scale, I have strong coupling at a tiny energy scale. On the other hand, this is just naive dimensional analysis. Once you do things more carefully, for instance, you actually estimate the size of loop corrections about a given solution, you'll discover that, thanks once again to Galilean symmetry, you have a number of interesting quantum mechanical properties. And for instance, you can show that you don't have any on Earth, if you look at the gravitational field of Earth, okay, you don't have any strong coupling until you reach distances of order a centimeter, okay? Which is kind of interesting because it's not so distant from scale at which we microscopically probe gravity. Anyway, so what I'm going to say is that from the low energy effective theory viewpoint, there is no real quantum mechanical problem. The real problem is that if you have superluminality, it means that the UV completion of the theory, the fundamental theory that should complete this theory at high energies, cannot be a standard Lorentz invariant theory, because in a standard Lorentz invariant theory, a kosher one with no non-renormalizable interactions, we do not have superluminality. I'm going to skip this because it's going to be covered by Paolo, I think. And so, conclusions. We focused on systems in which at short distances you can describe the modification of gravity by a light scalar degree of freedom mixed with the metric. And we implemented the Weinstein effect by demanding this Galilean invariance. And like all symmetries, it's a nice thing to have because it constrains the structure of the theory, it protects the theory against big quantum correction, etc. And we have a handful of invariant terms overall, which makes studying solutions a breeze. And we have stable self-accelerating solutions. We have stable Weinstein-like solutions. So from this viewpoint, we improve over DGP. But we do not improve over DGP as far as superluminality goes, because that was a problem of DGP, and we have it here as well, okay? And one thing I want to mention is that this system, as Paolo will tell us in a second, this system provides us with a consistent quantum field theory that can violate the null energy condition and give rise to interesting alternative cosmological histories. Thank you.
Maybe while we have questions, so are there any questions? And maybe something very basic. I think you're saying there is no combination of those five terms that give you non-superluminal excitations.
They give me what?
Non-superluminal excitations.
There are, in some directions, there are subluminal excitations, let's say, but there's always a direction, even a solution, there's always a direction in which you have superluminal excitations.
And no matter what's the combination of the
terms.
So, okay, so I have a fairly stupid question. But